we've done.
Okay.
If you don't mind, we're going to go ahead and start that now.
Okay, very good.
Okay. Today, this is the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today is November 18th, and it is 1:22.
2:15.
It's 2:15, I'm sorry. It's 2:15, yes. And we are talking to Sujit Kanagna Retna. Sujit, could you please spell your name for us?
Yes, it's the first name is spelled S-U-J-I-T, Sujit.
Uh-huh.
And then the last name is spelled C-A-N-A-G-A-R-E-T-N-A, Kanagna Retna.
And the R is capitalized, isn't it?
That is correct.
Okay. And what is your title?
My title is Senior Fiscal Analyst.
Okay.
And I'm with the Council of State Governments. And I'm out of their Atlanta office or the Southern office.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Now, when we talked last, you said that the situation for the states was looking pretty grim.
Yes.
Is that has anything changed?
Not really. In fact, I'm trying to think now. We talked, I think, back in July, maybe, or was it August?
It was in August. Yeah.
It was in August. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, we have a better idea about the revenue numbers expected for the upcoming fiscal year. So that will be 2011-2012. Most states have their fiscal years that run July 1 through June 30th. So mm-hmm. we are currently in FY11. And there are expectations about, actually, some fairly good forecasts about what states can expect to see in terms of their shortfalls for the current fiscal year and also the next fiscal year, FY12. So currently, the estimate is that states are looking at, have either addressed or will have to address cumulative shortfalls for FY11 that will total about $125 billion, which is a very sizable number.
Right.
Is that all 50 states and territories?
Yes. Well, right now there are four states that are in the enviable position of not having to face a shortfall, but it's 46 states that are looking at these massive shortfalls that will amount to about $125 billion.
Okay.
Going into FY2012, the situation becomes a little more dire, and the estimates currently are that the cumulative shortfalls will be about $140 billion.
Whoa.
And part of the challenge is the fact that the federal the Recovery Act monies that states were very fortunate to get, I guess, over the last couple 2 years will come to an end. And starting next year, states are going to have to devise solutions to deal with the shortfalls without this federal assistance that came through with the Recovery Act money.
Okay.
So, that's kind of the quick look at where we stand in terms of shortfalls. But, the last couple of years have been, very, very... staggering in terms of the numbers. I mean, in FY9, 10, and then obviously 11 and 12, I mean, the shortfalls have been just, overwhelming for states. Even though the revenue numbers have improved, most states are seeing an uptick in their revenues this last couple of months. It is still very anemic when you compare where they were pre-recession. They haven't really emerged from the slump that states were thrust into during the Great Recession, and that's so the improvements are obviously welcome, but it's still far below where they were before the recession began back in 2007.
What's the best way to compare that? Is there a percentage or dollar figure? What's the best way for us to express that?
Well, the best way would be looking at the shortfall as a percentage.
Okay.
Because you've got some states that obviously, have huge budgets. California, for instance. The estimate for California is already looking kind of dire. I don't know if you all saw the news.
Yes.
But even though the state and the government and the legislature were able to clinch a deal a couple of weeks ago in October, they're already looking at a shortfall that might be about $25 billion.
Right.
For this current year. So So my recommendation is that you look at it as a percent of their particular year's budget. For instance, if you look at the shortfall as a percent of the FY 2011 budget, you get, I think, a fairly good idea as to where states stand. On average, states are looking at a shortfall of about 19% of their FY 2011 budgets in this year, in this current fiscal year, on average. Most states have shortfalls that are double-digit shortfalls, right, in terms of percentage-wise. Mm-hmm. There are very few states with lower than a double-digit shortfall. Several of them are in the 20s and 30s, and states like Nevada, for instance, 54% of their general fund is the shortfall. South Carolina is also pretty bad, 25.6. Vermont is at 30.2. Georgia is 26.2. Connecticut, 28.9. Arizona, 36.6. So these are very, very sizable numbers that states are grappling with.
Is there any precedent for it?
No, unfortunately. You know, it's funny. I've been doing this job for about 12 years now, looking at state budgets, looking at state economies, and when the 2001 recession came along, I and so many other observers of state finances thought that, wow, this is pretty bad, but that recession was just a walk in the park compared to what we're experiencing now. So you got to go back 80 years, you got to go back to the Great Depression to get a grasp on the kind of complete revenue shortfall that we are just experiencing now. This is very unprecedented in that sense as well.
Okay. And one of the things that in the past I used to cover as a reporter,
right,
state trends and state budgets, and
uh-huh,
the states have limited options here with these enormous shortfalls.
So that is correct.
Is there a way for you to summarize, mm-hmm, how, when you say it's dire,
mm-hmm,
what kind of magic do they have?
Well, that's a very good point. 49 out of the 50 states have constitutional requirements that they have to balance their budget, so there's no way out of it. And, you know, unlike the federal government, we can't do, we don't have the opportunity to do what the feds can do.
Right.
So there are basically five broad strategies that states have adopted in the last couple of years. The primary one has been just completely slashing spending. That's been the major tactic that has been adopted, and I think I shared with Kristen a pretty kind of revealing graph about how when you compare FY 2008 state budgets with FY 2011 state budgets, you see the stark difference in the size of these state budgets. I mean, for instance, there are some states, about 37 states actually have seen their budget size shrink as a result of the Great Recession, and it just shows you that the fact that spending has been just slashed very, very severely. South Carolina, for instance, went down from a $7.5 billion budget in 2008 to $5.1 billion in 2011, FY 2011, a 32% decline. California went down from $103 billion to $82 billion, 20% decline. Florida went down from 28.2 to 23.3, 17% decline.
Mm-hmm.
So these are just very crushing blows in terms of having to deal with whether it's education or healthcare or a whole host of other activities that states have embarked on. And it's sort of resulted in what I have been calling the Great Transformation, where as a result of the Great Recession, states have been forced to sort of reorient their whole stance vis-a-vis the kind of programs and services they offer their citizens. So that's something that's been very very important in terms of how states have dealt with this. The other thing they've done pretty actively is tapping their rainy day funds. Coming out of the 2001 recession, states really built up their rainy day funds, and obviously the rating agencies were quite pleased about that.
Right.
So what you've experienced now in the last couple of years is that they have aggressively tapped these rainy day funds just to bolster their key areas of spending. Mm-hmm. Another favorite strategy is expanding gaming.
Expanding what?
Gaming.
Gaming.
Yeah, gaming. And I'll come back to a point I'll make all the way at the end in terms of the fifth strategy, but expanding gaming has proven to be a fairly convenient way to raise revenue.
A nice regressive way.
Yeah, you could definitely make that case. And you have something like 18 states that have either increased or working on increasing the number of gaming options they have. The other thing, another tactic states have adopted is raiding a whole host of funds. So you have across state government an assortment of trust funds that are supposed to be used for very specific purposes. But what's happened is in an effort to just corral together money to balance their budget, states have just basically raided these different trust funds.
With IOUs to pay it back later.
Possibly. That, you know, hopefully will happen, but it's still, I guess, too early to say.
Could you give an example of that?
Sure.
Kind of funny.
For instance, in Louisiana, this past year, for them to pull together their budget, the legislature and governor, they basically corralled together $182 million from more than 40 dedicated funds. In Florida, you had House lawmakers proposing sweeping something like $798 million, and Senate lawmakers proposing a smaller amount, about $295 million, from these different multiple trust funds just to balance their budgets.
Yeah, what are these trust funds? I'm sorry.
You'll have, for instance, funds specifically dedicated for transportation. You'll have funds that are specifically dedicated for, I don't know, like drug rehab programs. So you might have sort of a reserve fund in these different state government operations that were specifically targeted for a particular kind of program or service that are now being tapped to meet the balanced budget requirements of these states.
But basically, it's budgetary sleight of hand because you're moving something from one category to the other.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And then all these efforts are sort of geared around the fact that raising taxes is extremely politically radioactive in this day and age. And policymakers, whether they're Republicans, Democrats, governors, they are extremely hesitant to follow this approach. So, a whole host of different tactics are adopted to, you know, avoid the situation where you might be considered somebody who has raised taxes. Now, having said that, it's important to note that in FY 2010, the fiscal year that finished June 30th, 2010, I guess about 5 months ago, states did raise a record $24 billion in taxes and fees, even though a bulk of that involved tax increases in California and New York. This year, 2011, there are much fewer tax increases in the works, a little over $3 billion, you know, particularly since it was an election year.
Mm-hmm.
But you also had sales and income taxes going up in a number of states, Kansas, New Mexico, Arizona, Oregon, for instance. You also have states jumping in on some of the sort of sin taxes. So cigarette taxes, alcohol taxes, those are taxes that have been raised pretty aggressively. You also had states raising a tax on sodas.
Well, that was New York.
Caffeinated, yeah, sugary drinks and all that.
That's supposed to raise a billion, right?
Well, it all depends. If you see that effort actually has faced some setbacks. For instance, in New York, it's been hard to push through, even though the governor has been a big advocate of that, Governor Patterson in New York. And
mm-hmm.
in Washington, was one of the earlier states to introduce a soda tax.
Mm-hmm.
They actually had to go back and repeal some of that recently.
Oh.
So it's not a whole bunch of money, but it's sort of something that has been brought into the state coffers. And you also see a host of fees, all these different kinds of fees that states levy on their citizenry. For instance, whether it's parks, using some of the parks, fishing licenses and hunting licenses.
The arts.
Yeah, mm-hmm. those kinds of smaller fees have been jacked up.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, Another tactic to raise revenue has been the leasing of state assets. And this is something that states have been trying to do for a number of years now, because this the political toxicity of raising taxes has been around, I guess, for about 8 or 9 years. And even during the last recession, coming out of the last recession, you saw policymakers trying to adopt this approach of leasing these big state assets like highways for toll roads and lotteries and student loan portfolios, state-run liquor stores. Obviously, Virginia, it's been a big issue in Virginia recently, North Carolina has been trying to do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So all these different state assets have been, they've either tried to lease them or already leased them, and there are a number of instances of that as well.
Okay. Let me ask you, is it dire enough with the loss of the Recovery Act money? Can you imagine the states turning to Washington for additional help?
Well, I mean, given the given the current political environment, I think that's going to be extremely difficult, not only from a state perspective, but also from the Washington perspective. Also, keep in mind that now, given the election of 2 weeks ago, Republican control of a majority of the states, I think there's something like 29 governors that are now Republican. You also have a whole host of legislative chambers that are now controlled by the Republicans. So the whole approach of going to Washington to secure assistance, I think, is going to be less palatable for a lot of people. So I don't think that's going to be very much on the cards. I mean, just reading some of the pronouncements of the key policymakers in these legislative chambers, that's certainly not on the on the radar screen. The item they keep talking about, and I just read the a speech by the Senate President in Florida yesterday, and he's talking about how they're going to look at some shortfalls, and what they're going to do is they're going to have to cut. I mean, his thing is we're going to have to cut spending even more. South Carolina is looking at possibly $1 billion shortfall, and they're talking about the same thing. We're not going to raise taxes, and obviously we can't go to Washington because that's going to run up the federal debt. So what we're going to do is we're going to cut spending. Mm-hmm. So I think this is just going to reinforce the point I made earlier about this great transformation. State governments are going to have to citizens and state governments are going to have to come to some kind of an agreement on what exactly the role of government is and what kind of services the government is going to provide to people and how this is going to be financed, because obviously without the financing it's not going to happen. So I think that's going to be the key factor.
Thank you. That's great. That's what we needed.
Let's talk specifically about some of the services that you've heard. Have you heard of any services being cut any place that just startled you?
Oh yeah, in fact, I've got a big folder here that let me see if I can pull it out, and I've got a. Before we end up, I should also talk to you about post recession. In other words, once this recession, once the national economic recovery is more robust and we are on track to generate more jobs. Unfortunately, the revenue picture for the states kind of lags the national recovery by about 18 months. So it's going to take a while for states to see their real benefits. But there are some structural flaws in state tax systems that I'd like to mention to you all, because I think that's very key. Because even when the recession ends and state revenues recover and state economies recover, there are these three elements that are basically corroding state tax systems, that these structural flaws that are going to actually prevent the kind of expansion that states need to focus on sustained substantial economic growth. But we can talk about that later. But so you want to sort of hear about some of the more scarier scenarios as a result of these kinds of budget cuts, is that right?
Yeah, just things that you're hearing.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
For instance, police departments in a number of places across the country, Oakland, California, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Norton, Mass., have basically been forced to tell their residents that they have to file their own reports or online for break-ins or some lesser crime. So in other words, if you come to your house, you find your house being burglarized, you call the cops in Oakland, California, they're not going to be able to come and help you.
You have to file your own crime report?
You
got to
file your own
victim?
Report. That is correct. Tulsa is the same way. They just don't have the budget. Just don't have the resources.
But how does that comport with insurance requirements? You have to have a police report, right? So you can just fill out your police report and your insurance company will accept that?
Probably. I don't know. I mean, that's not the...
I see a burgeoning area for insurance fraud.
Oh, sure. Sure. So, I mean, that's one thing. Another very scary scenario was the fact that so many firehouses around the country have been shut down, or they either have rolling brownouts, where we're talking about Philadelphia and Baltimore and Sacramento.
Philadelphia, Baltimore, Sacramento.
San Jose actually laid off 49 firefighters back in August. And then Lawrence, Mass, just north of Boston, they've laid off a whole bunch of firefighters and shut down half of its 6 firehouses. So basically, you just got 3. And what was unfortunate was in San Jose, as a result of the cutbacks to the fire departments, there was a little boy, a 2-year-old little boy, who had an emergency and I guess he ate something and he started choking, and they called 911, and I guess the fire truck, they came in later than they would have if they had been close by, and the little boy died. So that was probably the most extreme example of this.
When did that happen?
This happened back in August.
Okay.
This was...
Has the family sued the city?
I don't know. I haven't really, followed up on the second and third layer of complexity as a result of these kinds of, cutbacks. But
so if you live in San Jose, you want your neighbor to come and drive you to the...
Pretty much. And then y'all might have heard about the incident in Tennessee where an individual, this particular town had a private fire department. So in other words, you had to pay, I don't know, it's like $100 or something.
Right.
And if you have a fire, they're going to come out there and, help you put it out. So this house apparently had some kind of a fire, and they actually had the coverage, the private coverage, the fire company came out. But by the time they came out there, the neighbor's house also caught fire. Now, the neighbor did not have the coverage from the private company. So they basically refused to help him. So his house burned down.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so those are two examples of fire and police departments. And then obviously, in terms of some of the other cutbacks are pretty sizable. You've had something like in FY 2011, which is, the current fiscal year we're in, 31 states have initiated health cutbacks. 29 states have cut back services to the elderly and disabled. 33 have cut services to K-12 education. 43 have cut funding for colleges and universities. And also 43 states have actually shrunk their payroll systems. So in other words, you have much fewer employees. And that's a pretty sizable number. As a result of the Great Recession, it's something like, I'll tell you the exact number here. Let's see here. Several hundred. Here we go. Since August 2008, so in about a 2-year period, states, localities, and school districts have eliminated 231,000 jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another indication of how.
And is that for 46 states or?
Yeah, for all. That's for all 50.
All 50.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So if you look at state, local, and county and school districts, it's something like 231,000 jobs.
Okay.
So you have, and then you've got, roads and highways that are just, states and counties just don't have the resources to bring them up and do the maintenance that is necessary.
The four states that are, because of a peculiar complex mix of factors, are doing okay are the Dakotas and Nebraska, and what are they?
It's actually Montana. For FY low 2011, which is the current fiscal year, those four states that do not have a shortfall are Montana, North Dakota, Alaska, and Arkansas.
Oh, and Arkansas.
Yeah.
I get Alaska because of the oil money. North Dakota because they're just 12 people who live there. I'm just kidding.
Right. And they also have, Montana and North Dakota also pretty energy rich and, as you noted, very, very, you know, small populations. I don't know, maybe 500,000 people or something like
that. But what happened with Arkansas that
is... Well, Arkansas has been sort of late... it was kind of late coming to the recession, and you know they didn't see the kind of housing boom that so many other states saw, so they kind of stayed pretty static. And you have several other states that have maintained it that way, where you know didn't see the huge surge in housing prices and the huge construction sectors that say drove a lot of the growth in you know the Floridas and the Nevadas and the Arizonas and the Californias. So Arkansas is a little unusual in that sense. But they're also reporting that they will not experience a shortfall in FY 2011.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess if you didn't feel the boom, yippee, you're not going to feel as much of
that. That's right. Now, obviously, you are going to face some of the national, the slowdown in the national economy. And the fact that, you know, you're still going to, you know, feel some impact, some adverse consequences, and they did. But basically, in FY 2011, they have noted that they will not face a shortfall in their in their budget. So they're obviously quite pleased about that.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you think the stimulus money that came from Washington masked the problems until now?
Well, you know, in a sense, it sort of allowed states to not make the kind of drastic cuts that they would have had to if they didn't have it during the height of the recession. Uh-huh. Now, the expectation for the stimulus obviously was that by 2011, the economy would have recovered to a large extent and that states would be able to stand on their own two feet, as it were. So, I think it was a very important element in ensuring that state governments were able to continue in the way they did, because without the stimulus money, it would have been pretty, it would have been quite disastrous, I'd say, if states did not have those stimulus monies, because, you know, you were able to help teachers. Obviously, there was a component of tax cuts which helped stimulate some of the economic activity, as well as you had a whole bunch of the economic development projects, and then obviously sort of the transportation angle that was pursued with as a result of the stimulus money, and then also you had a whole host of renewable energy projects that came about as a result of the stimulus. One example I keep talking about is in Charlotte, North Carolina, a company named Celgard, which is a great example of a company retooling itself to get ready for the 21st century by making lithium-ion batteries, and they've got several tens of millions of dollars from the stimulus money, and they've been hiring hundreds of people, and that's one of the green shoots of growth, I guess, that are there, and I talk about them in my presentations that I do. It's not like it's all doom and gloom. Mm-hmm. It's out there, but they are kind of kind of hidden, I guess.
Can I follow up on that? I know at the last National Governors Association winter meeting, I interviewed a lot of governors and with my colleagues where I was working as a journalist, and some of the Republican governors, as we recall, were quite, I would say, hostile to the idea of taking the stimulus money or using it. And Governor Sanford was an example. But then, but then there was some second and third thoughts, and the states accepted the money, used the money, even if the Republican governors were not so eager to say that they had. I'm thinking of when I talked to Governor Mitch Daniels. And we had an interesting discussion about how much Indiana had utilized.
Right.
What were there any states, just remind me, who that initially said that they wanted to refuse the stimulus money and and did stick by that?
No, not a single state. Everybody came around and finally took it.
Yes.
Sanford of South Carolina was the one that I think tried to hold out as long as possible.
Right.
So he held out the longest, but eventually he came around and took all the money. And it was the same with Governor Perry in Texas and Governor Jindal in Louisiana. And then obviously, I'm trying to think... those are sort of the...
Haley Barbour took the money.
There you go. He sure did.
He sure did.
I mean, they all did, finally. Sanford held out for the longest, like I said. And part of the sticking... one of the points he was trying to make was the unemployment insurance fund.
Right.
And that was the amount that he held off taking. But then finally he came around and he's taken that as well. South Carolina has one of the most intractable unemployment problems. And their unemployment insurance fund is also one of the worst in the worst shape among the different funds in the country. And we can talk about some of these big sizable expenditure categories looming on the horizon as well. But all the governors finally came around and took all.
Well, that's why I wanted to ask you, because you were talking about a 25.6% shortfall for South Carolina, and I just wanted to remind myself as to whether.
Right.
That problem had been exacerbated in part because they had eschewed taking federal money. But you're saying that, no, they did accept.
They did.
They did accept it.
Unfortunately, the current shortfalls obviously are emblematic of other issues going on in the state in terms of the economic situation, and it's not necessarily as a result of not taking, because they took all those monies. I mean, they did, even though they've been pretty critical of them.
Yeah, I guess the question I'm trying to get to here is, it seems like these shortfalls happened, but they got masked for a while.
You could say that. You could make that case.
And now people are going to really have to live within their means.
And what it is, and it's actually more than that, Christine. I mean, I mean right now states have cut back so much. I mean, you've gone through the fat, you've gone through the flesh, you've gone down to the bone, and now you're basically searching down into the marrow. I mean these cutbacks are very, very severe. And it'll only get more in the coming year in FY12, just because the federal monies are not going to be available, and that's what I was trying to imply by this conversation, this dialogue that needs to occur between government and citizens as to what is essential, what are the core set of services that state government should provide, and if that's what the people want, that's what they're going to pay for, and that's what they're going to get. So that's what it's going to come down to.
Even with more Republican governors, we've seen in the past that the governors themselves, regardless of party, tend to come to Washington with a different perspective, oftentimes because of the... I mean, they may be slow to express it, but it eventually...
Right.
I mean, they are very limited. They understand there are limitations, and they have to meet those obligations. You were going to tell us about some of the structural tax issues that are...
Yes.
Can you come back to that now?
Sure.
Okay.
So the point I'm trying to make is that even when the economy begins to tick and, states... begin to see better times on the revenue front, there are three structural flaws in their tax systems that will continue to plague them. And it's sort of imperative that policymakers start looking at these structural flaws and try to remedy these. Now, you have a fair amount of action in various state capitals and various legislatures on this count, but at the same time, it's still not sufficiently gaining momentum. The first one is the fact that our economy has now shifted from a manufacturing / agricultural economy to one based on the service sector.
Mm-hmm.
So about 80% of all U.S. jobs and is attributable to the service sector. But when state sales taxes were devised, back in the 1930s, the service sector occupied a minuscule share of the overall economy. So even though we have made this massive shift to to the service sector, most state sales taxes do not cover a rise. They do not apply to these whole range of services, which in turn means that they basically gloss over a lot of the economic activity that is going on. And I think that the best example of that is the fact that in 1955, the top company on the Fortune 500 list was General Motors, mm-hmm. a manufacturing company. 55 years later, in 2010, the top company on the list was Walmart, a service company. So even though you've had this, movement towards a service-driven economy, the sales tax, the traditional sales tax, is applied to an increasingly shrinking proportion of economic activity. And that's the unfortunate situation where, states have 20th century tax systems in a 21st century economy. So that's going to be a huge problem that has to be dealt with.
Is there a state that's a good example that has hit this head on and tried to alter it?
Well, there are three states that actually have broad-based sales taxes. There's a breakdown that I use. There are about 168 different services that are taxed in the states across eight broad categories. And there are only three states that actually have broad-based sales taxes that include a bulk of these services. They are Hawaii, New Mexico, and Washington. Mm-hmm. There are several others that are also pretty decent in terms of the amount of services they tax, South Dakota, Delaware, and West Virginia. But beyond that, most of the states do not tax services. So, for instance, professional services like doctors, lawyers, accountants, engineers are taxed in only seven states.
Mm-hmm.
So what tax experts recommend is that you lower the rate of the sales tax, mm-hmm. but you broaden the base to include more of these services and more economic activity.
Mm-hmm. So are you, I mean, obviously governors and states understand this.
Yes,
but
certainly.
But what the major impediment is political to making the alteration?
Exactly. Governor Schwarzenegger in California appointed this commission along with key members in the legislature, and they did this very comprehensive report looking at the California tax system. And one of their key recommendations was to look at this as a problem area. Governor Rendell in Pennsylvania, Governor Granholm in Michigan, they've all pushed this in pretty aggressively. Legislators in Maine, in North Carolina, in Kentucky, they've all talked about this and have sort of pushed this. So it's out there, but you run into the political wall of the point I made earlier about how raising taxes is considered politically toxic.
Okay.
So that's one key point in terms of the structural flaws. The second one is the massive growth in e-commerce transactions.
Yes.
Which have, profound impacts on the economy. Just to give you some numbers here, in the first quarter of 2001, e-commerce sales was about $8.3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
In the second quarter of 2010, about 10 years later, it had exploded to $39.7 billion. So you see the rate of increase there. Mm-hmm. And even as a percent of total sales, e-commerce has also risen very, very rapidly, from 1.1% in 2001 to 4.1% in the second quarter of 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, because of various U.S. Supreme Court rulings and federal inaction, state and local governments continue to lose sales and use tax revenues because of their inability to collect taxes that are due from these e-commerce transactions.
Mm-hmm.
And the numbers are pretty big. I mean, the University of Tennessee has done some excellent work trying to estimate what state and local governments lose, and it's billions of dollars. For 2012 alone, the aggregate losses are estimated to be around $11.4 billion. Those are big numbers, and obviously the bigger economies, the bigger states, the Californias, the New Yorks, and the Texas, they lose many multiple billions of dollars.
Has there been an academic study that looked at the possible projected e-commerce, squelching of e-commerce if there was a tax system in which taxes were collected off of the?
All kinds of analysts have looked at that as a point, but I think the overall point they're trying to make is that there's an equity issue here, Main Street versus, doing it online, that kind of thing. And there is a huge effort on the part of a number of states. There's this group called the Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement, which is an effort to sort of voluntarily collect these taxes from and have sort of an equitable system of collecting these taxes fairly efficiently. So you have all kinds of retail people, you have state policymakers, state revenue departments that have all sort of worked together to form this group called the Streamlined Sales Tax Agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to sort of bring about some level of equity here in terms of how e-commerce and Main Street are treated.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's definitely point number two. The point number three in terms of our tax clause is the fact that pretty much every state has massive amounts of sales tax exemptions embedded in their state tax codes.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously what these exemptions signify obviously is the influence of special interests. But even a partial repeal in some of these areas could result in, you know, billions of dollars in new revenue. And this is another area that has gathered a lot of interest in states, including among some of the Republican-leaning legislatures like in Florida and Georgia. Republican legislators, Republican policymakers have come out and said, hey, we need to go back and take a look at our exemptions. Some of them have been on the books for decades. They might not be valid or applicable anymore. We need to just go back and look at these to see which ones are relevant in this 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
So those three things, those three structural flaws, it's imperative that policymakers look at these because, you know, regardless of what happens and when our economy starts ticking upwards again, these issues are still going to hold back state revenue systems.
Well, if Washington is going to take a hard look at taxes, I assume the states are going to feel the door is open to look at it.
We hope so, too. We hope so, because this is, like I said, you might come out of this recession, but you're still not going to be completely out of danger in terms of your revenue situation if you don't make progress on these three areas.
Right. How about property sales tax issues?
Property taxes?
Yes.
Well,
the
big push, obviously, in the last couple of years, particularly during the huge surge in real estate values, was that states needed to initiate measures to sort of curb the growth in property taxes. So a host of states did that. So you have states that sort of put a ceiling on the level of property tax increases that could happen under these surging real estate prices. But what we're experiencing now is the reverse, where you see real estate values declining precipitously, but obviously your property taxes are not going down at the same level. So there is now a lot of pressure from the citizenry on policymakers that you need to lower our property taxes because our houses are not worth what they were, say, 3, 4, 5 years ago. Coupled with that is the fact that, you know, counties and cities rely on property taxes to embark on some of these very essential expenditure categories that they are in. So when you have cutbacks there, you're gonna already these counties and cities are in trouble in terms of their fiscal situation. So efforts to lower their property taxes even more would pose additional problems and challenges for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of, again, goes back to, you know, the other point I made where, policymakers and citizens have to figure out the specific programs and services they expect from state government and how they're going to pay for these. I mean, these things obviously don't just happen in a vacuum, right? So that goes back to the point that, you know, I'm trying to sort of create as a theme here. I mean, this core, you have to have this dialogue. What does this Great Recession mean in terms of enacting this great transformation? I mean, what are these services? What are these programs?
Do you really think, I mean, I know you've talked about green shoots of growth.
Uh-huh.
But are states seeing an improvement in their economic situation?
Well, I mean, compared to, say, 2 years ago, most certainly, in terms of, obviously, job creation, in terms of revenue numbers, in terms of economic opportunities, all that's certainly moving in the right direction. But is it moving fast enough? No, I don't think so. But compared to, say, fall 2008, when the bottom pretty much fell out of the economy, It's a pretty impressive turnaround in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got a long way to go. And I mean, the other point that I'd like to make is that states also have these enormous fiscal challenges looming in a number of areas. And what has happened now is policymakers have basically kicked the can down the road. I'm talking about areas such as healthcare and education and public pensions and emergency management and infrastructure and transportation and unemployment insurance. These are huge, huge, sizable expenditure categories that have to be grappled with. And that'll only happen when things calm down, I guess, on the revenue front. I mean, I've drawn this analogy where it's kind of like you've got a house with a leaky roof, and what states are doing now is running around with a pan trying to collect the water when the water, you know, seeps through the little holes in your roof. But what you really need is a new roof. But, you know, states just don't have the resources to go out and get that new roof.
Right.
Yes. One of the things that is one of the problems this immersion has come up in our field hearings but has been discussed internally here in the commission is that it's, to some extent, the states have themselves to blame for having allowed their budgets to swell so much during what has turned out to have been an artificial boom.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, the point I made earlier about states having balanced budget requirements means that every year you actually had to balance your budget, at least in terms of your current fiscal year. But I think where the problem lies is when states sort of avoided some of these big issues, and I'm talking about the huge expenditure categories that I just recited. For instance, pensions. I mean, there's been a woeful neglect of state pension plans over the last 8 or 10 years, which has resulted in states accumulating huge levels of unfunded liability. Unemployment insurance. Now you have almost over 36 states that have gone to the federal government hat in hand to get loans to continue making the unemployment insurance payments. And this is billions of dollars. Now, how did that come about? Obviously, we're in the worst recession since the Great Depression with record high unemployment rates. But at the same time, states kind of shot themselves in the foot by expanding benefits without really heeding the costs and then cutting taxes on some of the employers that would have replenished these unemployment funds. You have a couple of states that actually stand out as models that others should emulate. I'm talking about, for instance, Maine and Oregon that did very well on their unemployment insurance funds. So, I mean, you know, you do have the positives, but you're right. I mean, there are some instances where state policymakers just drop the ball, as it were, in terms of not taking care of these problems adequately, whether it's pensions or infrastructure, just postponing the very hard choices that are involved in dealing with these major problems.
You said they avoided
Hard choices involved.
Okay.
In dealing with some of these major challenges.
So they avoided the hard choices during the run up.
Yeah, I mean, for instance, when you are in economic good times, you want to bolster, you want to replenish your unemployment insurance trust fund because you know there's going to be a downturn, so that way you can rely on this now bolstered, now this healthy unemployment insurance fund to continue making payments to those that are unemployed. But a lot of states fail to do so. You expanded benefits and you cut taxes. So now you are broke and you have to go to the federal government to get loans, which eventually you're going to have to pay interest on that could run into billions obviously is going to cost states even more money.
Were New York and Texas among the states that had to borrow?
Oh, yes. In fact, New York, I know right off the bat, yes. The biggest one, obviously, is California.
Mm-hmm.
And I can, I have a nifty little chart here, and I can pull it up on my computer and show you. I can quickly read off some of the states that are Yeah, Texas obviously is there, and then California is obviously the big one. Indiana is in very, very bad shape in terms of its unemployment insurance fund. South Carolina is in bad shape. Pennsylvania is in bad shape. North Carolina. So, you know, you've got a host of states that are looking at some pretty grim numbers in terms of their unemployment funds.
Do you think it's fair, as has been written this week in the descriptions of California's budgetary problems, that collectively the legislature and the, I guess, the citizens of California wanted to make a bet that the economy would recover? In other words, they had grown their way out in the past, and that they hoped that the recovery would kick in and they wouldn't have to face some of these hard decisions. Is that oversimplifying it?
Well, I mean, there's probably an element of truth there, because California is such an amazing example where when the turnaround happens, revenues flow in there like nowhere else, because they've got a very sort of unusual tax system that is particularly reliant on the high income groups for a lot of the revenue.
Right.
So, and also on capital gains taxes. They're overly reliant on capital gains taxes. So, for instance, when, you know, when the markets are booming and obviously real estate transactions are booming, which obviously is not happening in California, but so, you know, that turnaround, that's been the trend in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not completely out of the ordinary to expect something similar to happen. And yesterday's New York Times had a great article by David Leonhard. I don't know if you saw that. A lot of the tough choices that obviously states and the federal government will have to and have been making would be mitigated some if there is growth. And that's obviously a panacea for a lot of the problems we face. But then, you know, obviously the challenge is getting there. How do you generate this growth, I guess?
Right, right.
So,
well, it's budgeting with your fingers crossed.
Right, which is obviously not a very, I guess, strategic way to do it. But, going with the occurrences of, you know, the last couple of recessions, and obviously the housing sector was a major boost to help us come out of the last couple of recessions. Unfortunately, it hasn't been the case this time around, because the housing sector and construction sector's collapse was one of the major factors associated with the Great Recession. So, but it's definitely a sort of a situation where states have constantly to revise their revenue forecast downwards. And finally, now 2+ years into the recession, after the recession was announced, I guess that trend is changing. But like I said, we've plummeted to such low depths that the improvements are obviously welcome, but it's still nowhere near where we need to be in a comfortable situation.
Can I ask you to analyze, in the context of the national foreclosure crisis, and I put quote marks around the crisis, but this trend of foreclosures, what are the budgetary pros and cons that governors and state legislators would want to think about in terms of modifications versus foreclosure?
Right. Well, you know, I think that's a key point in terms of generating the kind of economic stability and economic growth that will eventually flow from that stability. I mean, allowing people to remain in their homes, I think, is a key ingredient in ensuring that we have an economic growth path that will be, substantial. So I think the efforts, we have to redouble our efforts to ensure that we stabilize the foreclosure crisis, because that's an area where a lot of the uncertainty related to the economy revolves around.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the efforts that have been made to date, I think, have to be reconsidered and sort of redoubled, just because without the level of stability that comes from being assured that you're going to be in your home, or as opposed to being kicked out and allowing yourself to be in a mortgage modification, I think is going to be a key element in ensuring that we get back on the growth path.
So I just want to make sure I clarify and understand. As far as you know, the evidence would suggest that in most cases the modification is the better thing for the legislature or the governor to be thinking about in the long-term stability of, you know, the marketplace.
Well, yeah, I mean, in an overall sense, in a sort of a general sense, I think that's the better approach as opposed to having this huge level of uncertainty and instability that will ensue as a result of having this specter of foreclosure sort of hanging over you. I mean, I know we are still on target to have a record number of foreclosures this year, and it's just something that that has to be dealt with. And I guess there are various ways to do it. And I think getting into the process of modification might be one opportunity to sort of bring about, I guess, that level of stability to the economy. That'll be beneficial in the medium to long terms.
Do you know of any governors or state legislators, just anecdotally, that have tried to argue this point, as the federal government is trying to figure out how to respond to this?
Right. Well, I know, obviously, the four states with the most severe crises in this area, Florida, Arizona, California, and Nevada, obviously would see the, you know, should see the most action in terms of this issue.
Right.
But there are obviously other states also. Now, I know North Carolina and Maryland, for instance. Maryland has been particularly, I know, active on trying to deal with this crisis in terms of their own the houses that are under danger, under threat of foreclosure there. So the Maryland model might be something that might be appropriate to take a look at more in a more in-depth model, in-depth fashion, I guess.
But is the Maryland model is helping the homeowners with financial assistance versus actually wrestling with the banks?
Well, I think there's a there's a whole range of options, a range of assistance that they provide. And in fact, there's a unit that used to be headed by Tom Perez, who I know is over with the federal government now. In fact, I had somebody from his office come and speak to our legislators back in 2008 on this very topic and the kind of programs that they have introduced. But they offer a whole range of services, including help with dealing with the banks, negotiating with the banks, and also at the front end, trying to ensure that people that get into mortgages know what they're getting into, can they afford this mortgage, those kinds of key questions that obviously should have been done, and as we know, obviously in many instances were not done by the banks, I guess. So you see a mixture of these different kinds of services and programs that are offered in Maryland that actually have gathered a fair amount of national attention.
Right.
So that might be something that might be worth taking a greater look at. Obviously, North Carolina has also done some efforts, but the one that I'm sort of more familiar with, I guess, is the Maryland model.
Did you have another question? There were a couple things we just wanted to make sure that we had on the record from you. Some things you had said to us before that were just very excellent quotes. You told me that in terms of state finances, the situation has been, and you said, cataclysmic. Is it? Do you recall saying that?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly. I guess you could say it was cataclysmic, and it's probably going to get better, but it's most certainly cataclysmic would be a pretty good description, I guess. Yes.
Okay. And there was a point at which you described the accumulated budget shortfall. You described it, and you gave us slightly different numbers today, but you said these are staggering numbers. Here's what you told me. These are staggering numbers. And then you said, it's not just the big states. It's all the states. And
that is right.
I think what you really, I don't want to, put words in your mouth here, but
right.
We want to get this exactly right because
sure.
You've told us a few states aren't as in such bad situation. In fact, some have a balanced budget. So I wondered if it would be okay if we said, these are staggering numbers. It's not just the big states. It's almost all the states.
That's correct. That's fine. Yeah, I think when we chatted, we might have been actually looking at FY 2010. And FY 2010, I think it was 49 out of the 50 states that had had looked at shortfalls. So,
yes.
So that could be, you could say almost all states, yes.
Yeah, we just want to make sure that we have something in there that also reflects.
No, that's accurate, and that's fine.
Alexis, was there anything? I think that's pretty much going to do it for us.
All right.
You have been so helpful, and...
On such a grim topic.
It is. But we didn't get to talk more about the green shoots of growth, but there are some pretty exciting things happening out there, and hopefully those projects and those economic development efforts will lead to more sustained, stable growth in the states in the coming years.
Well, you had given me a list of things, the green shoots of growth that you
right.
had done in a presentation. And
right.
I'll pass this along to Alexis, and if we end up using any of them.
Yeah.
Was there anything that was in your original presentation that, anything that went belly up since?
Yeah. Well, no. Everything's
still going forward.
Yeah, all those examples are good. Yeah, I'm trying to think. I was invited to do a presentation before the FDIC in October.
Yes.
And I'm trying to think. So I spoke to you in August, is that right?
Yeah, hang on. Let me tell you what
was in. I might have given you, I did a presentation before the Labor Commissioners in July.
You did one for the National Association of Governmental Labor Officials.
That's it. Those are the Labor Commissioners. That was in late July. But I did one to the FDIC's economists in August 7th, October 7th in Dallas. And I will send you that presentation.
That would be great.
That has a few more recent examples, but I think I used some of the same examples from what I did in July, but touched on some of the renewable areas, obviously solar. There's some exciting solar projects, some wind projects, and then obviously the auto industry in the south. There's some biotech projects that are pretty exciting. So I can shoot you an email with the link to that presentation.
That would just be fabulous.
One other quick question. What happened to Vermont?
Oh, in terms of the 49 out of the 50?
Well,
the
statistic that you used, the number, the double-digit number, was so horrendous.
Right. Well, it's Vermont is 30.2% for FY 2011. There are states that have actually have larger shortfalls than that, but it's a state that has really been hit by the recession and trying to stay afloat.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite states. I mean, I went to college there, so I have a lot of fond memories of that state.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sure is.
And those brown and white cows are so cute.
That's right.
I just was wondering if there was something extraordinary other than just the general strike.
It's sort of the overall sweeping effects of the Great Recession, I guess, pretty much creeping into every state in all kinds of forms. And I guess states that are less nimble in terms of dealing with some of the issues are going to face more, larger obstacles, I guess, to overcome.
Right.
So.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. This was very helpful. Thank
very
you
good.
So much.
Have a happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, you too.
Bye-bye.
Okay, goodbye.